Chapter 8, Whaling Voyage Round the World. One of the most iconic pieces in the Whaley Museum collection is the painting entitled Whaling Voyage Round the World by Benjamin Russell and Caleb Purrington. At 1,275 feet long by 8.5 feet high, this rotating panorama is believed to be the longest painting in North America. In the middle to late 19th century, it was popular for European and American audiences to see the world through public performances, such as dioramas, panoramas, world's fairs, and lantern slideshows designed and executed by those who had experienced exotic locales firsthand. Of particular importance to the success of these public spectacles were the perception of authenticity and the promise of a unique and entertaining story. In this regard, Benjamin Russell of New Bedford had no rivals. He did, in fact, travel around the world as a whaleman for over 3 years, making sketches of his voyage along the way that would later inform his enormous panorama. Even in a whaling city, a whaling voyage lasting up to 4 years was considered a romantic, dangerous, and fascinating adventure, and tales from those who had lived it were thrilling. For those who never made it around the world on a whaling voyage, and even for those who had, a panorama was their ticket to experience the drama, danger, and beauty of life as a whaleman from New Bedford across the seas and all the adventures in between. The popularity of moving panoramas, the forebearer of modern cinematography, was at its peak when Benjamin Russell returned to New Bedford from his 40-month whaling voyage on the ship Cuttisoff in 1845. Russell merged his artistic talent with Yankee entrepreneurialism to embrace the trend. He hired Caleb Purrington, a local house painter, to help fill in his giant canvas and take his quarter-mile painting on the road to paying customers nationwide. For 25 cents, one could thrill at the experience of a giant moving panorama unrolling on two immense spools and showing whale ships departing New Bedford to travel the oceans of the world. A narrator accompanied the panorama. Sometimes it was Russell himself, and sometimes it was some noted New Bedford whaling master like Daniel Mackenzie. In addition to explaining the hunt, the narrator would describe the shipboard views of Fayal and Pico in the Azores, the volcanic eruption of Fogo, and the development of Praia on the plateau in Santiago, Cabo Verde, the dangerous rounding of Cape Horn and the exotic Fijian islands, all as the panorama inched along. The performance lasted for about 2 hours. According to the Boston Post in 1849, everybody must go and see it, for we assured them it is, without exaggeration, a production of surpassing excellence. Russell's work was an amalgamation of many stories with which his audiences were well familiar. While already years in the past when Russell left on his whaling voyage, the sperm whale's attack on the Essex was still a story fresh in the minds of those who sent their sons to sea in New Bedford as they saw the tale play out on Russell's panorama. Other scenes of fanciful note included Masa Tierra, an island off the coast of Chile where Robinson Crusoe's inspiration, Alexander Selkirk, was marooned, Pitcairn Island, where the HMS Bounty mutineers had set up permanent residence, the mutiny on the whaleship Sharon, and many other stories familiar to Russell's audiences. To visually break up the long ocean crossings that could take weeks, Russell employed day-to-night scenes that suggested the passage of time. The voyage is not entirely logical, but designed for effect in that some of the journey is in reverse and some dramatic detours are taken. Russell's tour ends in St. Helena, off the southwest coast of Africa and not in New Bedford, so technically he was shy of a circumnavigation. This was perhaps in deference to the ending point of another important panorama, Sinclair's peristrophic panorama, which followed the exploits of Napoleon Bonaparte, whose last stop was also St. Helena. In these artistic choices, the panorama is indeed a piece of visual culture, giving us great insight into its contemporary audience, their interest, and the fashion of the day. Perhaps most importantly, the Purrington-Russell panorama is invaluable as an historical document, illustrating like no other resource the path of expanding commercial dominance of the United States in remote and exotic ports, and the Yankee whalers' interactions with other cultures. Chapter 8 Profile. Go West, Young Man. Point Loma in San Diego was discovered by the Portuguese navigator João Rodrigues Cabrillo in 1542, when he sailed there from Mexico to lead an expedition to explore the Pacific coast for the Spanish crown. 300 years later, and because of the 1849 gold rush, the port of San Francisco had become an irresistible magnet to sailors, so much so that whale ship owners instructed the masters of their vessels to avoid San Francisco when outfitting for refreshments or repairs. They encouraged their captains to visit Hawaii instead, because the chance of desertion was less attractive in the middle of the Pacific. With the ascendancy of Azorean captains and crew by the mid-19th century, it is no surprise that Portuguese communities developed early in Hawaii, and the first Portuguese fraternal organizations were formed there in 1878. Large-scale agriculture of sugar and pineapples drew laborers from the Azores and Madeira. Among the most significant cultural adaptation resulting from the influx of Atlantic Islanders was the iconic Hawaiian musical instrument, the ukulele, stemming from the Madeiran instrument, the cavaquinho. The Mexican-American War, 1846-48, helped to consolidate American influence in California. Shore whaling was about to begin along its coast, and San Francisco Bay was poised to become the terminus of the Transcontinental Railroad, completed in May 1869. With the completion of the railroad, the literal and figurative capital of whaling inexorably moved west. The whalers hunting in the Arctic dramatically shortened their route to market by unloading baleen and oil in San Francisco. Crewmen came and went, and as ports like San Francisco, San Diego, and Honolulu grew to be important cities, the diversity of their settlements expanded. Atlantic Islanders, largely following kinship patterns and hopes for economic prosperity, moved west, greatly aided by the Transcontinental Railroad. Former whalers who had ventured inland for the gold rush later settled in the fertile valleys of California as cowboys and ranchers. By the 1970s, roughly half of all dairy farms in the San Joaquin Valley were owned and operated by Portuguese Americans and contributed to making California the number one dairy producing state in the nation. Starting in the mid-19th century, many Portuguese Americans turned to shore whaling as they could farm in the slow summer seasons and live with their families year-round. The capital required to start a shore whaling business was more than 80% less than that of an offshore whaling enterprise, which made this business model very attractive to Portuguese immigrants with the skills and ambition, but not the financial resources. They quickly became the dominant cultural group engaged in over 20 California shore whaling stations from Crescent City to San Diego Bay.